Thank you, music team. So much appreciate it. Well, I have to tell you, I really struggle hard to come up with jokes for you guys on Sunday. And I did find one that I will share. And it starts off with this squirrel who is resting peacefully, sleeping up in his nest way high atop of this tree. And all of a sudden, there is this terrible rumbling, and the tree just starts to shake as if there's an earthquake going on. And the squirrel's really scared, and he peeps out over the edge of his nest and looks down, and he can't believe his eyes because what he sees is an elephant climbing the tree. And he yells down to the elephant, "What the heck are you doing?" And the elephant looks up at him and says, "I'm climbing the tree to eat some pears." And the squirrel says, "You moron, you idiot. This is a fir tree. There aren't any pears up here." And the elephant says, "I know. That's why I brought my own." All right. Maybe it's not, you know, maybe it's a little lame. But it was really important for me to find a joke that had something to do with climbing trees. And there were a couple of others, but I couldn't get them by the censor. Up tree. When we hear the phrase up a tree, it's kind of equivalent to up a creek without a paddle. In other words, we kind of associate that with not being in a good place, being in trouble, with not an easy solution for getting ourselves out of that. But today, we're going to twist that around a bit. And we're going to regard being up a tree as being in a special sacred space or spiritual place. Because today we continue our series on Bible stories. And our story today focuses on Zacchaeus. Anybody ever heard of him? Not a lot of hands going up. And there's good reason for that. Zacchaeus has really a minor character role and is somebody that is really obscured. He's only found in the Gospel of Luke. And a grand total of 10 verses are dedicated to telling his story, and those can be found in the 19th chapter of that gospel. But according to the story, Zacchaeus lived in Jericho, and he had several things going against him. The first one is that he was not just a tax collector, he was a chief tax collector on behalf of the Romans, charged with collecting taxes from his own people, the Jews. And the second thing is that he was a man that was very small in physical stature. Or as we might have to say today to be politically correct, he was vertically challenged. And you may not believe this, but even today in our present culture, short people often are the victims of discrimination and bullyism. They tend to be not regarded as being as attractive as taller people. And they happen to be the subject of a lot of scorn and a lot of jokes in our society. But that's just the way it is, and that's the way it was back then. But returning to the story, one day Jesus decides to travel to Jericho, and he's going to be passing through the town. And Zacchaeus gets wind of this. And he had heard so much about this person of Jesus and the healings that he had done and all the miracles that he had performed and how he just seemed to attract a crowd absolutely everywhere that he went. And he was intrigued, and he wanted to get at least a glimpse of this guy, Jesus. And it just so happened that as Jesus passed by the area where Zacchaeus was, Jesus was surrounded by a crowd, and because Zacchaeus was so short, he couldn't see. He couldn't see Jesus. And I could relate to this. It's been a long time since I've seen a parade. But what does he do? He hightails it down the road that Jesus is going to continue walking on until he comes to a sycamore tree. And he climbs up on top of that tree so that he can get an aerial view, a bird's eye view of Jesus when he happens by. And when Jesus comes to that spot, he stops and he looks up into the tree and he says, Zacchaeus, climb down from that tree and go on home because I want to visit your house today. So Zacchaeus climbs down and he hurries home to welcome Jesus. And the people that were part of Jesus' entourage all weren't very thrilled about this. They didn't understand it. How could it be that Jesus was going to end up spending a fair amount of time with the sinner, with this tax collector? But Zacchaeus is overwhelmed, and when Jesus comes to his house, he makes a pledge to Jesus. And he says, I'm going to take half of what I own and sell it and give the money to the poor. And I'm going to repay fourfold to anybody that I have ever cheated or scammed or swindled in any way. And Jesus responds with a proclamation of his own. He says, behold, salvation has come to this house, for he too is one of the sons of Abraham. And the Son of Man has come to seek out and save those who have been lost. It's an interesting story, short story, with all kinds of metaphysics involved in it. And I think there are things in this story that absolutely apply and relate to all of us, at least on some level. So let's go back and review it, and starting with the point of his physical stature. Zacchaeus truly was a little guy. And it prevents him from seeing, at least initially, it prevents him from seeing the Christ. But as I said, he has much more going against him than that. Because as his role as a tax collector, he had to lean on his own people. And the Romans no doubt had quotas that had to be met for his particular district. And it didn't make any difference to the Romans. As long as they got the quota, they were satisfied. So he was free to do whatever he could, whatever influence he could, to get people to cough up more money and scam them and cajole them. And all of that was gravy for him. And so he was a very wealthy, rich man. And as I said, to say that he was not popular would be an understatement. And you could imagine the mirroring that his own community gave to him and sent messages to him that not only are you small in physical stature, you are small in character. And they would have been filled with contempt. And so this whole thing about being small in stature serves as a metaphor for that image that they gave back to him, probably of actual hatred in some cases. And it also serves as a metaphor of the self-image that he must have realized or felt and experienced every single time that he looked at himself in a mirror. We all can relate to this, I think, on some level. I think we all have areas in our lives in which we think and wish that maybe things could have been better. Even those of us that are the most confident and the most secure can look at areas in our lives and think of things that we're really not pleased with ourselves about. And in fact, the more confident and the more full of bravado that we are, the more likely it is that we're just trying to obscure things and hide things that we think about ourselves that we regard as being really, really small. The world always has and still does set incredible standards for us to meet. And then we are measured up against those standards. And we are judged on so many planes. We're judged based on our income. We're judged based on the type of house that we have. We're judged by the color of our skin, by our sexual orientations. We're judged based on our education levels. And we're judged based on whether we are tall or small in stature. And yes, we are always judged based on our looks. Some of you may not believe this, but there are people out there that think that this beautiful head of mine isn't quite what it should be because there's not enough hair up there. But that's the reality of the world that we live in. And in every single time, we are greeted with one of those so-called failings, according to the standards of the world, that sets us up to regard ourselves as possibly being a wee bit smaller. As we get up close and personal, it actually gets worse. It's difficult to stand tall when somebody opts out of a relationship that we're in. It's difficult to stand tall when we're in an abusive relationship with a partner or a parent or maybe even with a child. And it's a sad reality that all of the scientific evidence shows that any child that comes out of a home filled with violence and turmoil at some point assumes the guilt and responsibility for that. And they end up living their lives that they must have been the party that have been responsible for all of the things that had to be endured in that household. Whenever something goes wrong, we never are quick to rule out that it must have been us. So maybe we lose a job and we think, well, okay, they said it was just a general layoff. But, you know, at the very least, I should have seen this one coming and maybe done something about it to prevent it. And we do it to ourselves as well. There's probably not a person in here that could really relate to being a tax collector. But at one time or another, we all have compromised our lives to some extent. We've cut corners and we've taken shortcuts in our relationships. And perhaps there were times in our lives where maybe we were a little, or maybe a lot, less loving and caring and present and responsive to somebody in our life who really needed us to be there at a given time. And maybe we've made decisions in our life that at the time we were making those decisions, we actually realized that decision was not in the best interest for somebody around us or for ourselves. And maybe because of those times when we've had those really unpleasant experiences, we have come to find ourselves a bit short or lacking. And we lose sight of that truth that each and every one of us is a beloved child of spirit. And our self-image moves from that to that of a commoner. And we fall in line with some cultures in which the commoners are not even allowed to make eye contact with royalty. And so we inhibit ourselves from seeing that Christ, that absolute reality, that Christ presence as it parades by us, which, by the way, it does absolutely every single day in our lives. But even more sadly, we allow it to inhibit ourselves from seeing the Christ that dwells within. Nobody could be tougher on you than you. Nobody could beat you up more than you can beat yourself up. But the consequence of all of this is nothing but a self-image in which we actually see a reduction in terms of who and what we are. But there is good news in this gospel story. And the good news, plain and simple, is that regardless of how the world may view you, and regardless of how you may view yourself, you matter. You absolutely, positively matter. Each and every one of you is either a son or daughter of Abraham, meaning that an incredibly powerful, beautiful, miraculous, loving legacy is yours. You are important, you are loved, and you matter. And it makes no difference if you're male or female, black, white, brown, yellow, red, or chartreuse, what the size may be of your bank account, or even if you have a bank account, or what your sexual orientation may be, or what your educational level may be, whether you're tall, short, medium, or whatever. You are so worthwhile. And again, you are loved. And again, you matter. This is the basis. This is the crux of the whole Black Lives Matter movement. And yes, that was a movement that was born out of the African-American community in response to things that that community has been subjected to historically and continue to be subjected to in a lot of ways. But the message of that movement, the affirmation of that movement, is universal. You matter. And that message has the understanding that things have been tough. And that message has the understanding that maybe you've been misjudged on a grand scale, or maybe you've just been misjudged by your partner in a relationship. And maybe you didn't get a break when you should have gotten a break. And maybe you've been held to be accountable to standards that really had absolutely nothing to do with who you really are and what your character is. But none of that matters, because you are what matters. And if at some point along the way you are feeling lost, it's important for us to remember that Spirit is working 24/7 to find you and to bring you back home. At the end of the gospel story, Jesus makes a proclamation. Salvation has come to this house. We don't tend to talk very much about salvation in Unity, despite the fact that for centuries, salvation is the product that mainstream churches have sold to the people. Come and join us. Listen to what we say. Step in line. Follow these rules that we have made. And if you do that, it's going to guarantee that you are going to reach the pearly gates of heaven after you die. Or maybe if it's a bigger concern to you, it's going to guarantee that you're not going to spend all eternity burning in hell. In Unity, we kind of view salvation a bit differently. In Unity, salvation means ascending to a higher, greater spiritual consciousness and awareness. In Unity, salvation is all about the ability to see the Christ presence in the world and in ourselves, and then to embrace it. And if you can manage to do this, or to the extent that you are able to do this, you will be in heaven now, because you have made a choice to live in the kingdom of God that exists in this very moment. So what is ours to do? Well, first we have to get motivated. We have to allow the Zacchaeus in us to hear about the wonders of that Christ presence in the world, and to hear about the miracles that are waiting to happen for the world and for ourselves. And then secondly, we have to open ourselves up to a possibility and just say, you know, maybe it's true. Maybe I do matter. And we have to allow ourselves to open up to the possibility that maybe it really is incredibly significant and important for us to try to view that Christ presence in the world. And then if we do those first two steps, the remaining step is we need to move to a higher ground. Throughout the scriptures, whenever there's any kind of an indication of arriving at a greater, higher depth of consciousness, a greater awareness, it always involves a movement, an upward movement. So that's why Moses had to climb and transcend up that mountain to be in communion with the Lord. And that's why Jacob had to travel to the city of Haran, which was located high in the mountaintops, before he could go to sleep and have the dream that he had of the interaction between himself and God. And in modern day times, this is precisely what Martin Luther King Jr. was talking about when he says, I have been to the mountaintop. Because he had the awareness that all of the junk and the garbage and all of the pain and the suffering and the dissonance and the polarization of the world did not need to be that. There was a real, honest-to-goodness, viable, tangible alternative available to us if we just allow ourselves to see it and to embrace it. And returning to the story about Zacchaeus, Zacchaeus had to climb that sycamore tree. Not to get a physical view of Jesus, but to allow himself to have an awareness through a spiritual viewing of the Christ. It was important for him to arrive at a place where he was be able to see beyond the physical. The sycamore tree in the story represents those times, those places in our lives that are our opportunities to have a clearer vision of the Christ. And the story makes it perfectly clear it's going to involve some positive action on our part to get there. And I never want to minimize the importance of going into meditation and having a really strong meditative practice and being able to go into the silence and listen to that still small voice within. But make no mistake about it, this story is telling us that we're going to have to find and climb our sycamore tree if we really want to be at some higher level of awareness. We talk about a spiritual path. The reason that it's a path is that it's intended to be walked. It's not okay to get off of the path and pitch a tent someplace and just sit patiently waiting until Christ happens by. Each and every one of you has your own sycamore trees. I have my own sycamore tree. This church, this family, this spiritual family of Unity of Fox Valley has its own tree to climb. And the divine order in this whole thing is we don't wait until we are feeling healthy and good about ourselves before we start to climb the tree. That's like, I'm going to take off 20 pounds before I go to the health club. Rather, the divine order in this thing is that we begin to climb our trees precisely so that we can begin to feel healthier and have a better perspective about the world in which we live and about ourselves. So how do we know what these sycamore trees even look like? Well, the first thing I will tell you is that they are absolutely everywhere. And they're really not hard to see. They don't try to hide. But all you need is some sort of openness, you know, to begin to enter into that process with those trees. The second thing is you'll know if it's a rightful sycamore tree for you if it involves some level of work. So what are some examples? Well, I don't know. Maybe we get up and get busy and get involved in the Black Lives Matter or the Me Too movement or some other movement that is meaningful to it for us today. Or maybe we respond to a crisis when it occurs. This past week in Prospect Heights, I'm sure many of you have seen it on the news, there was a major fire. This is just a few blocks away from where Susan and I live. 96 household units were burned and over 300 people were displaced and left homeless. So Thursday night, Susan gets the bright idea, we should go through our closets and just pick out all the clothing that we rarely wear and whatever and put it all together and take it to a distribution center. And I didn't verbalize this to her, but my internal reaction was, I am so tired and exhausted. And I happened to be working on this talk at that time when all of a sudden it was like, duh, sycamore tree. So I said, let's go. in 45 minutes. We went through our closets and our dresser drawers, whatever. We gathered together five large bags of stuff, and we took it over to the distribution center. But maybe your sycamore trees are a little more subtle. Maybe the tree that you are being called to climb is the tree that has you paying greater attention to all of the people that pass through your life on a daily basis. Maybe your sycamore tree and climbing it is about being more in a state of kindness and tolerance for somebody that you absolutely can't stand. Maybe climbing your sycamore tree involves at long last letting go of the darn grudge and forgiving somebody. Maybe it involves being just a little bit engaging the next time a homeless person hits upon you. Again, the point is the sycamore trees are ever present, waiting for us to climb up and gain a greater, higher view of what's really important and a greater insight as to the purpose of why we are here. You might argue, of course, that it was a much different story for Zacchaeus than it is for us. I mean, after all, think about it, Reverend Mike. He was trying to see Jesus, and he had heard all about these incredibly wondrous things that Jesus was doing. And let's get practical about this. How does this really lay out for us? And maybe you have a point. But the most significant point of the story is Zacchaeus had to climb the stupid tree. He didn't have to, really. He could have made a decision not to. He could have chosen to remain small. And notwithstanding all of the junk that we hear on the news, each and every one of us at one time or another hears about the wonders of the Christ presence in the world. And we too have a decision to make in response to all of that. And we too can choose to remain small. But being small doesn't serve anybody. And it especially doesn't serve you. So my advice to you today, go out and find your sycamore tree and then go for it.